This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
I've got a couple of tunes going through my head.
Oh.
If I could talk with the animals. And anyway, sorry, I've foreshadowed what you're going to talk about.
The Melbourne Zoo. Look, it's something I've visited all my life. I've seen and enjoyed the changes from the cages and concrete prisons that have housed the animals to the more natural habitats they now live in. Noel Harcourt has written a book about being on the other side of the fence. His book's called For Keeps. Welcome, Noel.
Good morning. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Noel, what job did you have for 33 years?
Oh, yeah, being a keeper of various species of animals. I started off in reptiles, worked my way through education species. So we had animals within the education. First seals, then onto carnivores, where I spent the majority of my career, and then onto primates.
Lots of animal-loving people would be envious of your position, but you didn't get it easily. In your last years at school, you were doing... What were you doing over the Christmas holidays?
I actually worked at the zoo for three consecutive years as a general dog's body at Melbourne Zoo.
You got good with a broom, I hear.
Yes. I was always in awe because I was always in the presence of some magnificent animals. So I was probably caught more often looking at the animals than I was doing my mundane tasks.
Of sweeping up the poo. Now, as a boy, you had an interest in reptiles. There's a photo of you holding and wearing shingleback lizards and skinks. And what about fish? That was also an interest?
Yeah, I've always been interested in fish. I used to have carp that I used to catch from the Edwards Lake Park. And a number of other fish that were sitting in fish tanks on top of my bookcase in my bedroom.
And you knew how to care for them,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I knew how to look after everything, yeah. It was just a fascination for me.
Your father was keen for you to get a profession rather than to follow your animal interest. But even while working, you were volunteering at the Reptile and Fauna Reserve. What were you doing there?
Well, I just missed out on a job at the zoo in 1984, and I felt I needed some more experience. So I got a job at the Fauna Reserve up in Monbulk, and I work with a range of animals, pumas, lions, tigers, native fauna, reptiles. And, yeah, it was pretty fascinating task and learned a lot over the time I was there.
Well, you mentioned that there were big cats there, but not when you first started. Where did they come from? Because this is something, I think, if you've lived in Melbourne, you'd remember this.
Well, they had pumas at the time when I started, but they acquired some lions and some tigers from Bacchus Marsh Lion Park that had closed down. So we moved a tiger from Bacchus Marsh Lion Park through to Monbulk, which was a couple of hours' drive, in the back of a covered F-100 truck with chicken wire between us and the driver's seats. So that was quite a hairy experience.
Absolutely. Did the animal enjoy it?
No, he was a bit pacey. And, you know, those were the days when we never bothered to put him into a crate or anaesthetise him for the trip, but that was the way things were done those days.
And what about the neighbours all around?
Yeah, when the tigers arrived and we got lions, there was a bit of trepidation about the people that lived around Monbulk, and sometimes there was notes left on the fence as to why you've got them, but we assured them that they were very safe and give them a free ticket to come into the zoo and have a look at them. So they walk away quite comfortable.
And they're usually noisier at night?
Yeah, it can be a bit noisy when lions fire up, or tigers, particularly lions, when they start vocalising, can you know, be heard over a large range of distance, yeah.
Well, as you mentioned, you were 28 when you were first turned down by the zoo to train as a guide. But at 33, you were finally offered a job as a zookeeper, and you were worried about telling your dad.
I'd worked as a contracts officer at CIG in Preston, and I was there for 11 and a half years, but I always had that passion to be a keeper. So I had to kind of walk over to Dad and sit down with him, and he was all for it. He knew that was my passion and had always been my lifelong ambition. So he supported me, and he was very, very supportive.
And it was the reptiles that you were first
in
charge
of. Yeah, in the reptile house, yep.
But you had to feed them, and this is sort of something we don't know, is you actually had to grow their food too.
Yeah, we had live rats and mice. We used to breed mice, and we had mealworms. We also had crickets, grasshoppers, probably maggots, a whole range of invertebrates that we'd feed off.
I'm going to get Noel Harcourt to read a little bit from his book, because this is something I never knew about and I should have thought about it. This is an aspect of the zoo we often don't get, and it's from page 42.
Underneath the reptile house was another area that they had to bend down to enter, which referred to as the dungeon, and for all intents and purposes it could very easily have been used as one. It had several corridors that ran from the main area deep under the reptile house. The main area accommodated several trays of meat-eating beetles, or dermistids as they are sometimes technically called. These beetles could strip the flesh off dead animals within weeks or months, depending on the size of the carcasses. Various departments would use the beetles to clean up carcasses for the Education Department or Melbourne Museum. Then once the beetles had done their job, the skeletal remains could be glued together. Due to the rotting carcasses, the area stank and at times was very difficult to enter, not being able to escape the smell as there was no ventilation. It was the place, as you could well imagine, we spent the least amount of time in.
Oh, yuck! But a necessary job too. And of course we're talking about the beetles cleaning everything off the bone, but you also had to clean cages, and there was a wonderful bit about having to get the perspex insulation off the crocodile's cage, off the ceiling.
Yeah, the end of every winter, between the roof of the reptile house and the wire, which basically was underneath the battens, there was perspex that would keep the heat in the reptile house, and we'd have to crawl up into that cavity, pull off the perspex sheets, drag them all the way to the off-limit centre area, wash them down, scrub them and put them back again. And we had to climb over the saltwater crocodile exhibit where we had Auntie and Oscar. And Oscar would see you, and even though he couldn't get you, he'd actually leap out of the water and snap. So at times it was quite misconcerting.
Oh, my goodness. And you didn't get danger money for that, did
you?
No. Just a thrill. Now, thanks to you, we have reptiles in habitats instead of glass boxes. There's a water display that I remember well with mangroves, fish, aquatic snakes and green tree frogs. And then you moved out of the reptile area into the marine mammal department. Well, tell us something you did there.
I looked after the Australian fur seals with another crew of three. The exhibit itself had been transformed from an old monkey exhibit, and some amazing work done on it to bring it up to standard. It was salinated water. And we would work with the seals, but we never got them to jump through hoops or have balls balanced on their nose. We actually trained them to show their natural behaviour. So they could show their flippers, they could vocalise, they could jump into the water and porpoise, or they'd come up and sit next to us, and we put our fists out and target them. So they put their nose on our fists so we had their immediate attention. Once they did what we asked them to do, we actually fed them fish. Until the session was completed.
And we could see them swimming underwater.
That's right. Had wonderful. The underwater seal viewing area.
Yeah. Well, then you went on to the carnivore section, dangerous, and moving a dead lioness who died from natural causes, but her daughter would not leave her side.
Yeah, that was an experience I won't forget.
Oh, so working with these big cats and the necessity of having to learn to shoot.
Yeah, we had our FRP team, which was a firearm team that was professionally trained, and people had to go through all kinds of barriers to actually achieve that. That is psychological barriers, actually talk to a psychologist and have a complete medical, be fully trained by expert people, because there's always the case when if something does or if gets out that you can depend on these people. And it was very important.
Yeah. One skill, and then in contrast, another skill, you really had to learn how to butcher animals.
Yep. We used to get live goats or live sheep in, and we taught how to use a bolt gun, and we would dispatch of those animals. We had to winch them up and then gut them over a bin and then prepare them for our collection, put them into freezers or fridges.
Mm. And sometimes companies worked with the zoo on promotions, and I love the one about the car company who wanted to prove how strong the car was.
Yeah, they had a Holden car, new model, and they decided for PR that they'd put it in the lion park. So we put it in the lion park, and we had nine lions at the time. And
smeared it with blood.
Yes, we kind of gave them a little bit of incentive. After a period of time, they pulled off the actual front bumper bar. The two males got hold of it, and even though it had the handbrake on, they managed to pull it a couple of metres across the park.
How long did it last?
It lasted a couple of weeks, I think. But it wasn't too bad. But, yeah, it was knocked around. They just lost interest in it in the end.
Yeah. And then something that the public did not lose interest in was the meerkats in the Meyer windows.
Yeah, that came at a right time. We had 13 meerkats in an exhibit near the front entrance of the zoo, and we wanted to put a glass front on it so the public could see right into it. And at that time, Meyer's had some functions in their window, and they approached us, and we suggested the meerkats, so that went really well. And it was good for the meerkats because they actually, Myers did everything that we wanted them to do. They were incredible, and they actually paid for everything. They financed the whole thing.
Noel Harcourt, zookeeper, what animal caused the biggest crowd at the zoo?
Oh, the biggest crowd.
Joe, who was on previously, remembered travelling from Adelaide to see it in 1988, the giant pandas.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yes, we had the pandas come in. We actually housed them in part of the new gorilla exhibit that was being built at the time. So before we moved the gorillas across, we were able to facilitate an area of their new exhibit to house them. Yeah.
The book includes history of the zoo and facts I didn't know that Baron Ferdinand von Mueller, who designed the botanical gardens, also designed the zoo gardens. And then the polar bear, who lived for 43 years but escaped one time. So what other animals have escaped from the zoo?
Well, back in the 1900s, when they had the bear pits, the only way they could facilitate the pits was that they locked the bear up into a den, get a long ladder, climb down the ladder, clean the pits, climb up again. One particular time, a keeper forgot to haul the ladder up and a bear got out. That was luckily when the public weren't around, and that was a long time ago.
And even longer ago, 1914, when a leopard escaped to Brunswick.
Well, there was another occasion when the Tivoli Theatre had an illusionist who wanted to borrow one of the zoo's lions, and it actually ended up at the Tivoli Theatre and actually got out, and it ended up in Little Collins Street. So the zoo was notified. This was a long time ago again, and it had to be re-caught. Yeah.
Look, talking about a long time ago, my memory goes back to riding on Queenie the elephant, but I was surprised that the butterfly house was opened nearly 40 years ago. Golly, it's been impressive, hasn't it?
The butterfly house was the beginning of the reconstruction of Melbourne Zoo, by Dunbaven Butcher, who was our CEO at the time. So, yeah, it's quite significant.
Yeah, we spoke about changes in the zoo, but you were also involved in moving some of the animals to the Werribee Plains Zoo.
Yeah, Jan Damara, that's the giraffe I'm with on the front of the book. We moved him from Melbourne Zoo down to Werribee Zoo. We had to do it in the early hours of the morning because part of the areas that we were moving him to, the council had to raise the tram wires so we could fit the whole thing underneath. And I recall going past a 24-hour takeaway food place, and a guy was just walking out as we were driving past, and he dropped his food on the ground in horror because this giraffe went past him in a box.
There's photos of you with a range of animals in the book, but there were two that I think you had a special affinity with, Missouri and Carliff. What were they?
Yeah, Carliff. I had an affinity with Hutan, his brother. I looked after Carliff, but Hutan. Yeah, Missouri, I spent some time with him before he went to Jersey Zoo and his den, and we mucked around, and quite a number of the staff, one by one, were able to go in and spend time with him. That was probably a sad time to see the world's only artificially inseminated gorilla go overseas. But, hey, it was great genetically to see that occur. And Hutan, who... just last week I visited the zoo after seeing him after 9 years, and he picked me out. He saw me and he came over and greeted me at the wire and actually stood up and rubbed his face against the wire and the glass as a greeting and chuffing. Yeah, he remembered me, which was pretty emotional actually.
Now, Noel Harcourt, I've got to ask you this. What's the most expensive animal to feed at the zoo?
The platypus, simply because yabbies are so expensive. But also fish. Feeding the seals at Melbourne Zoo was also a great expense as well, because it was always top quality food, and we never tried to supplement.
There's so many facts in this book. Snow leopards have an incredible leap, 9 metres, or 6 times their body length. Incredible. Look, so many other facts, so more interesting things. Noel Harcourt writes about his job for 33 years as one of the zookeepers at Melbourne Zoo in his memoir, For Keeps. Thanks very much, Noel.
Thanks for having me.
And no segue here, I've got crime fiction Michael Rowbotham's The White Crow. White crows are misfits. They are picked on by their fellows and struggle to survive. This notion is brought to life in Michael Rowbotham's latest tale of crime and intrigue, aptly named The White Crow. So, Michael, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you, David.
Our White Crow in this instance is Police Constable Philomena McCarthy. She doesn't fit anywhere.
No, she doesn't. She's a bit of an outsider. She's a young, ambitious London policewoman who has defied the odds to join the constabulary because she comes from a family of notorious East End gangsters. She's the White Crow. In many parts of the world, we refer to the black sheep of the family, but in Eastern Europe, they refer to the White Crow.
The initial crime here is a murder and robbery. We have the body of Caitlin Kemp Lowe tied up in her house, and the jewellery store run by her husband, Russell Kemp Lowe, ransacked. But that's only the beginning. Now, there are some very invested parties, or suspects, we could say. Russell Kemp Lowe's not all that innocent, shall we say.
Oh, no, with all of these things, the art of writing, I think, a crime novel is ultimately a puzzle. That's what people love. And there's a puzzle at the heart of this story.
But you've got some interesting tropes. There's the babysitter, Josie Shelton. I mean, surely that throws suspicion on Russell.
The story opens with this home invasion and a robbery, which are linked. And Philomena McCarthy, the young police officer who stumbles upon this. And then increasingly as the investigation emerges, you know, her own family, her father and uncles, become prime suspects. This is why she's caught between
the two worlds.
The two worlds. You're right. You know, there are multiple suspects. There are, you know, Russell Kemp Lowe. Is he purely the victim of this crime? There are babysitters. There are, you know, loads of people involved.
There's the babysitter's boyfriend.
Yes, there's all sorts of, you know, and I think that's the nature of what I do is to throw red herrings in there. And you want the reader to sit there going, oh, I think I know. And some of them will. Some of them will get it.
But Russell's got gambling debts.
Yeah,
that raises suspicion, surely.
Yes, and of course, it's lovely if you think you can fool everyone. And, you know, you want that moment in the story when the final reveal happens where the reader slaps their forehead and goes, oh, I should have seen that coming. The clues were there. And sometimes some people will pick it. And you don't mind that because as long as there's enough mystery and tension, they still want to know whether they're caught.
Whether they're caught and why they're caught or how they got implicated. But again, you've got even yet another suspect, Noah Kemp Lowe. What's his problem?
Well, I mean, this is the brother, I guess, you know, the wayward brother. The every family has that black sheep, as I mentioned. If Philomena is the White Crow, then Noah Kemp Lowe is the black sheep of the jewelry dynasty. Is he a reformed drug addict? You know, the man that spent time in prison. So he's another suspect.
But he's been disinherited, so he needs to get back into the family or get what he deserves, perhaps. So all of these factors are there. And now we get further intrigue because, as you've already alluded to, we have the McCarthy family, Philomena's family, Edward, Dad, a bit of a criminal. The McCarthy brothers were the most notorious criminal gang in the southeast of England, who were still in their teens when they were selling counterfeit and pilfered goods at market stalls in the East End of London. They graduated to hijacking trucks and eventually controlled the movement of every shipping container that passed through ports like Harwich and Dover, collecting fees to allow stevedores to load and unload them. The extortion racket was broken in the late 90s and Dara, Clifton and Finbar were sent to prison. So it's a crime family, basically.
Ultimately, if the story goes on and the McCarthys sort of while the three brothers are in prison, Edward McCarthy made his fortune during the London Olympics because there wasn't a slab of concrete laid or a piece of scaffolding erected without, you know, the McCarthy brothers being involved in some form. Now, in truth, there is a notorious criminal gang in the east of London run by a man called David Hunt. And he is known as the Big Fella. in real life. He's 6'5" tall. He runs a waste disposal business. And he made his fortune during the London Olympics. He is considered to be untouchable. He's never been convicted. He sued the Sunday Times in the UK for when they called him a gangster. He unsuccessfully sued them. But on the second day of the defamation trial, the Sunday Times had hired 5 bodyguards to protect their witnesses, and all the bodyguards walked off the job because they were so terrified by David Hunt and his crew. And so the Sunday Times had to keep hiring new bodyguards to try to protect their witnesses, but ultimately won that case. So this is in terms of, you know, life imitating art or art imitating life. I mean, yeah, the McCarthy brothers, there is sort of real life people behind them. And even just more so is that David Hunt began his career in a gang called the Sniper Gang, hijacking lorries that came from the ports of Harwich and Dover.
But the McCarthys and the Kemp Lowes are connected. How so?
Oh, I can't tell you stories like that. I can't tell you, you know, details of the... there's clearly a reason why the McCarthys become suspects in this crime. They could have been shopping for a watch or a piece of jewellery, but they were seen going in and out of the jewellery store in the weeks prior to the robbery.
So they are implicated and under suspicion, but this is where Philomena gets into trouble. She's actually found Daisy Kemplow, the child, and looks after the child after this, the murder and ransacking of the jewellery store. But what she's doing, is it good police work? Or is she actually casing the Kemplow residence for her father?
Well, this is the question mark, because as you say, she, you know, the book opens with her discovering Daisy Kemplow, a child sort of wandering the streets at night, and she takes the child home and discovers the home invasion. But later when she's obviously, because she's looking after this child, she becomes involved in the investigation. And it's only when, you know, the police are investigating and looking at CCTV footage and they discover that there's a link between the McCarthy family and this robbery. And then they realise that Philomena McCarthy is Edward McCarthy's only daughter, that the question falls, is she part of the gang or is she one of us?
And will the constabulary, the police force, support Philomena? Will her own family support her? Because now you amp up the problem, because we have the prospect of the NCA, the National Crime Agency, coming in, asking Philomena to do something. What's she being asked to do?
You're giving too much away.
Well, should she be loyal to the police force and give information about her family? Basically, she's damned whichever way.
She's caught between, and this is the ultimate, I guess, when I created the Philomena dilemma, that was always going to be the dilemma. She's going to be straddling this thin blue line between the police force and between her family. And this is at the heart. And the thing is, she doesn't know whether she trusts her father. She believes that her family are involved in this robbery. And so that's as much as I can say, David.
But also then, the McCarthy family are being pressured because the Eastern European Mafia is coming in to try and take over the McCarthy operation. And this becomes quite intriguing. Given 3 guesses and a phone a friend, Edward McCarthy would struggle to find Bulgaria on a map. He knows it's probably one of those Balkan countries like the Stans that used to be part of the Soviet Union. Violent, lawless places full of men with bushy mustaches and fur hats. Popov calls himself the Wrestler, a name that is meant to intimidate people, but the whole vibe of wrestling has homoerotic overtones. Half-naked men covered in oil, grappling on the floor. You got to ask yourself, thinks McCarthy. But they've come in to take over the operation. And how do they intend to do it?
They, you know, I guess it's a situation, whether in any form of industry or business, whether you are running, you know, cafes or making widgets, you will always have a competitor that will open up down the road that wants to take over your patch. And this is a situation where the McCarthys have, to a degree, become legitimate. They call themselves property developers. They now control a business empire worth hundreds of millions of pounds. But, you know, post-COVID and all sorts of things, it's teetering with heavy debts and delays. And so they're under financial pressure, the McCarthys. And suddenly you have these upstarts from, you know, the East who think these men are getting old, the McCarthys. They're old school. You know, we are younger, we are hungrier, we are more ruthless.
Well,
we can take over.
This is the ruthlessness, which you alluded to when you were talking about Hunt and bodyguards. What are they suggesting they'll do?
They are suggesting that, I think there's a line in there when it talks, where Popoff, you know, the Bulgarian, talks of the difference between he and McCarthy and what real power is. Is real power is being willing to do what the other person isn't willing to do. It's to have no boundaries. And I think that's the difference. McCarthy, you know, is a criminal and has done criminal acts and has been, you know, and used violence at times to get his way, the McCarthy family. But they have boundaries, they have rules, they have a code, whereas this new breed of criminal have no boundaries, have no code. There is no limit on what they are willing to do.
And they also have information.
Yeah, I mean, they have done their research. They've done their research. They know where all the weak spots are. They know about, you know, they know about McCarthy's debts. They know that, you know, he's under financial pressure, and they slowly put the squeeze on him. And ultimately, you know, you reach a point in reading the story where you think that there is no way out for the McCarthy family, that they are completely wedged by this new mob and will have to, you know, surrender.
Well, if people are prepared to do anything to get their own way, what option do you have?
Exactly. And so I think that this is the sort of the clever, I hopefully the part people will think is quite clever in this book is how they manage to actually extricate themselves.
But it also goes into the psychology, and there's psychology all the way through this. One of the intriguing ones is Daisy, the child, being interviewed by a psychologist to see if her the information she'll impart about what she's seen is accurate. How do they go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the research I did for the book in terms of it's a real skill to interview a child, and the ability to initially, you have to establish the child knows the difference between right and wrong, knows the difference between tricking someone and telling them the truth. And then you slowly, you know, have to take that information out of them. Because, you know, we all know that children, they fantasize about things or they can misconstrue things. But yeah, it's an important skill.
And the other psychology at play here is, well, Popov and why he's prepared to behave that way. People are certain people can be malicious.
Yeah, although it's interesting. Among the many people that I ghostwrote for in previous career was a brilliant psychologist called Paul Britton, who was the pioneer of offender profiling in the UK. And Paul Britton would always tell me that there is no such thing as evil, that society gets the monsters it deserves. We're all created ultimately by our circumstances, whether that be, you know, a terrible abusive childhood or deprivation or whatever. I guess the question mark that Philomena has to overcome in this book is in terms of, you know, who are the greater villains? The people that she's sworn to support and protect and wears their uniform and carries their badge? Or is it her family, the family that sort of raised her and where she came from?
Well, Philomena is caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. How does the situation get resolved of the McCarthy family being sort of, well, overtaken by the Eastern Mafia? Will she keep her job? What happens to her? The listener is going to have to get the book, The White Crow. It's by Michael Robotham, and it's a Hachette release. Michael, thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
There was a segue I could have used. I mean, criminals can behave like animals, but probably the animals have a better conscience than some of the criminals.
Well, you know, it is weird that some people want to actually get into the cage with animals.
Oh, dear.
That's something Noel wrote about too.
Dear only, am I.
So, and I was speaking with Noel Harcourt, his book For Keeps, A Window into the Fascinating World of Zookeeping.
Well, that takes us out for another week. Jan, we've got Resident Frequency Radio. You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.